It is Monday, September the 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, 25 die when attacked at a military parade in Iran.
It's a tragic attack. Women, children, all sorts of people involved.
Could a second Trump-Kim summit be in the works?
It stands to reason they would have a second summit and try to walk away with a more detailed outcome than they got the first time.
Also ahead, instruments of change. Tiger Woods overcomes a drought, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Accusations are coming out of Tehran following a deadly attack there over the weekend in Iran. We get more now from Reuters' Pascal Davies.
Iran is ready to confront the United States and its Gulf Arab allies. That was the message from President Hassan Rouhani the day after an attack on an Iranian military parade in which 25 people were killed,
a terrorist attack,
including 12 members of the elite Revolutionary Guard. On Sunday, Rouhani accused U.S.-backed Gulf states of providing financial and military support for anti-government groups in Iran.
The victims fell as innocent martyrs. Undoubtedly, the Islamic Republic of Iran does not overlook this crime. It is clear to us which group they belong to and where they are linked. Those who repeat claims of human rights must be held accountable.
On Saturday, gunmen opened fire in the city of Avaz, targeting a viewing stand where officials had gathered to watch an annual event, marking the start of Iran's 1980s war with Iraq. It was one of the worst ever attacks against the Revolutionary Guards, the sword and shield of Shiite clerical rule since the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
That is Reuters' Pascal Davies. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Cecile Shea, a non-resident senior fellow on security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She says the attack in Havas was serious.
It's a tragic attack. Women, children, all sorts of people involved. You know, as you just noted, a number of groups have claimed responsibility, and it's too early to know who is responsible or possibly even if there were a couple of groups cooperating on this type of an attack. The Islamic State has said that it's responsible. It's claimed responsibility for other attacks in the past, and it turned out not to be responsible. One thing that is concerning is the possibility that the Islamic State and one of the several pro-Sunni, anti-Tehran government groups operating in this area may have cooperated on this attack. And we don't know that yet, but it is a possibility. So it's probably too early. It's certainly too early to start saying precisely who is responsible for the attack, although I'm sure the Iranian regime is looking for the perpetrators and the planners as hard as it can.
Well, you know, this is a very tightly run, almost police state. How can such groups operate freely in Iran?
So you're right. It is a police state with a lot of layers of intelligence and security, especially in the rural areas. But it's also a physically large country. It's got a very educated populace. The city where this particular attack took place has a million residents in it. So I think sometimes people think of Iran as being more of a rural country, but in reality, a significant part of the population lives in urban areas. And so, yes, dissenters and groups like that can work underground and sometimes even quasi above ground. You know, in addition, this particular city is not that far from the Iraqi border. And we see the Iranian government is already closing a number of land borders to Iraq to try to keep any more attackers from entering the country. So they seem to think the attackers may have come from Iraq.
U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley on television Sunday, referring to Mr. Rouhani, said he's got the Iranian people protesting. Every ounce of money that goes into Iran goes into his military. He has oppressed his people for a long time and needs to look at his own base to figure out where that's coming from. She suggests that it may be domestically instigated.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly one of the possibilities, is that it's one of these ethnically Arab groups. There's a significant Arab population in this part of Iran, and the second largest ethnic group in Iran are Sunni Arabs. I think she's alluding to a couple of different aspects of this attack. First of all, there appears to be a climate change tie-in. There's a drought going on in this area. There seems to be a big problem with air quality on top of the drought, and people are upset at the government for not doing enough to take care of them, to protect them. Anytime that there's a drought, you're going to have a lot of stresses on the population, economic and other stresses, and instability increases. On top of that, she's absolutely right, this is a repressive regime, and one of the groups that is particularly repressed are Iranian Sunnis. So if the central government were less repressive to some of these groups, there, in theory, might be fewer attacks on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. On the other hand, if you are a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, you realize that if you gave more free hand to these groups, there might not be an Iranian Revolutionary Guard anymore. So what she's saying could be a call for ending the current government, which, you know, a lot of people have hoped for a number of decades, for a more open, democratic Iran. But the U.S. has said officially that it is not in favor or it is not working toward regime change in Iran. So from that perspective, I'm not completely clear on what she was saying beyond that the Iranian government should do more to worry about the economy and the environment of the population and should do more to respect the human rights of its minority groups.
President Rouhani will be, of course, in New York for the opening of the U.N. General Assembly session. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will also be there, and he suggested Sunday he's willing to meet top Iranian officials. Is this a good time to meet or a bad time?
Now, there's never a bad time to meet and talk as long as you are at least marginally prepared and you go in with your eyes open. So I hope that they do meet and talk. I think it would be great. I think the Secretary Pompeo has said today that, you know, President Trump would be willing to meet with either Rouhani or with the Supreme Leader himself. Again, if the president were prepared and had some kind of goal for the meeting, I don't necessarily think that that would be a bad thing. But I do think that we have to get back to the table and start talking again. I don't think that the current situation, ever since we pulled out of the nuclear deal, is conducive to the goals of either of our two countries. And right now it's actually working against our goals, because between our embarrassing the president, President Rouhani, by pulling out of the agreement, and now this really horrible attack on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, there's a real danger that the most extreme right-wing elements of the country are going to be even stronger than they already are. And we're not going to have that balancing leaven that was coming from a relatively moderate Rouhani, again, defining moderate in Iranian terms.
Cecile Shea, a non-resident senior fellow on security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump dined Sunday night in New York with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who is among a number of world leaders who are gathering at the 73rd United Nations General Assembly. The two leaders likely discussed trade differences as well as the situation on the Korean Peninsula, which would be just days after South Korean President Moon Jae-in traveled to Pyongyang and signed agreements with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Speaking on the NBC program Meet the Press, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the Trump administration is fully aware of the struggles to get Chairman Kim to honor agreements that were made at the Singapore summit with Mr. Trump, where denuclearization was a key element.
We have our eyes wide open. There is a long ways to go to get Chairman Kim to live up to the commitment that he made to President Trump and indeed to the demands of the world in the UN Security Council resolutions to get him to fully denuclearize. But our team is fully engaged in this. There are lots of conversations taking place. There's lots of work being done. It isn't all visible to the public, but we are fully engaged in the process. We understand the objective, and economic sanctions will remain in place until we get there.
Pompeo also talked about a possible second Trump-Kemp summit. VOA asked Joshua Pollack, editor of the Nonproliferation Review and a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, what might be on the agenda of a second summit that was not on the agenda of the first summit in Singapore.
In the first meeting, there was broad agreement on 3 points, an improvement in relations, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and commitment to peace. Actually, I got it in the wrong order, but that's it. And then there was, of course, also almost as a side agreement, restarting the search for remains from the Korean War. Those are broad points. There seems to have been little agreement about the exact substance or timing of those points. While the North Koreans had, even before the summit, committed to stop testing long-range missiles or testing nuclear weapons, and while they agreed at the summit to dismantle an engine test stand, there seems to have been not much meat on the bones when it comes to ending their nuclear program. And indeed, I doubt that they really intend to go as far as the United States would like them to. And when it comes to an improvement in relations, which could involve an end of sanctions or other things of that nature, there is not a lot of specific detail in the Singapore joint statement. So the next step seems to be to work out some kind of a framework or sequencing for these steps to decide what they mean and what order they will unfold in. So it seems that something is now getting moving, and if that process leads anywhere, then it stands to reason they would have a second summit and try to walk away with a more detailed outcome than they got the first time.
That's Joshua Pollack of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. In Baltimore, not far from Washington, a free after-school music program called Orchids is being used as an instrument of change for children in underprivileged neighborhoods. In the past 10 years, more than 1,300 children have received free music lessons and free instruments from flutes and trumpets to violins. The program, sponsored by the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, aims to create social change in a city where about 40% of the population lives in poverty. VOA's Deborah Block followed one teenage violinist who says Orchids has given her more opportunities than she ever imagined.
Here at the Seed School in Baltimore, 15-year-old Nima Robinson concentrates on a piece of classical music. For the past 4 years, Nima has been taking free after-school group violin lessons through Orchids.
It makes me feel happy because I know like I can do different styles.
Her teacher, Arum Kim, grew up in Korea and studied violin at the prestigious Peabody Institute in Baltimore. Kim says Nima's determination has helped make her a top student.
It's given someone like Nima the confidence and then practice to be in front of people, to have a skill set that you can be proud of.
Nima's musical journey started when she and her mother, Susan Johnson, watched a concert in Baltimore that showcased Orchids, not knowing that one day Nima would be on stage herself with the mostly African-American group.
And I'm elbowing Nima, and I'm going, that's what you should be doing.
Nima had a hard start in life, with both parents in prison. As a result, Johnson became both guardian and mother to her.
She's helped me a lot. She's my number one supporter. She fusses at me to practice. She pushes me. And, like, if it wasn't for my mom, I don't think I would, like, really be this good in playing.
Orchids has been instrumental in guiding many students, some from troublesome backgrounds, by providing a place where the children feel respected and safe.
Some of the students come in to the class, into the group setting, with the baggage from all day long. That could be poverty, that could be trouble at home. It's helpful when I learn about their families.
Aside from the camaraderie and encouragement that Orchids provides, Nima also enjoys performing.
I like seeing like the crowd, like the audience like come out and just like the end just clap and just stand up. That just makes my day.
Thanks to her free violin lessons, Nima was accepted into the Baltimore School for the Arts, where she now studies music. She hopes to earn a college degree in music so she can teach other black children, like herself, how to live their lives on a high note.
It doesn't matter what race you are. You can play music. If it's your passion, it's your passion.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Baltimore.
You should go to our website, voanews.com, and look up Instruments of Change. The video that goes with that piece, amazing. Time now for some sports. Pro golfer Tiger Woods has something to celebrate after ending his victory drought. AP's Graham Agars reports.
Tiger Woods has put an exclamation mark on his comeback season, claiming a two-shot victory at the Tour Championship. Woods posted a final round 71 to finish at 11 under, two clear of Billy Horschel. The win was his first since August of 2013 and completed a remarkable comeback from injury and the golfing wilderness. After several near misses during the year, Woods finally returned to the winner's circle. Justin Rose birdied his 72nd hole to claim the FedEx Cup and the $10 million that went with it. I'm Graham Agars.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Gladys Knight and the Pips. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists led by Johan Brox, an associate professor at the Australian National University, recently studied some fat molecules they had found on an ancient fossil. They say their studies provided evidence that allowed them to identify the fossil animal as a Dickinsonia and that it is the earliest known animal in the geological record. The scientists say the creature lived on Earth about 558 million years ago, which was about 20 million years before the so-called Cambrian explosion of modern animal life. Brox described this event as a time when complex animals and other life forms, like mollusks, worms, sponges, and arthropods, took over the fossil record. Brox and his colleagues described this primitive animal as being oval-shaped with rib-like structures along its body and measuring about 1.4 meters in length. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Right now, time for a little something from the world of music. Gladys Knight is an American singer, songwriter, actress, businesswoman, humanitarian, and author. She's best known for the hits she recorded during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s with her group Gladys Knight and the Pips, which included her brother Bubba Knight and her cousins Edward Patton and William Guest.
Yeah.
Neither One of Us was a huge hit for Gladys Knight and the Pips. They've recorded 2 number one Billboard Hot 100 singles, 11 number one R&B singles, and 6 number one R&B albums. And Gladys Knight has won 7 Grammy Awards. Midnight Train to Georgia was one of those Billboard Hot 100 hit singles. Knight was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1944. She first received minor fame by winning Ted Mack's The Original Amateur Hour TV show. It was a contest at the age of 7. That same year, she, her brother, and her cousins formed a musical group called the Pips. And of course, the rest is history. One of Gladys Knight's favorite songs talks about the good old days and what's next. It's a cover of Barbra Streisand's title song from the film The Way We Were.
Hey, you know, everybody's talking about the good old days, right? Everybody, the good old days, the good old days. Well, let's talk about the good old days. Come to think of it, as bad as we think they are, these will become the good old days for our children. But why don't we try to remember that kind of September when life was slow.
In 1996, Gladys Knight and the Pips were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. One year before, Knight had received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. In 2007, she received the Society of Singers Ella Award, at which time she was declared the Empress of Soul. Gladys Knight is on Rolling Stone's list of the greatest singers of all time. She's been married 4 times and has 3 children.
The skies were bluer and smiles were bright. Can it be that it was all so simple then? Or has time rewritten every line? And if we had the chance to do it all again, tell me, would we, could we, memories like the corners of my mind. Mm-hmm.
misty watercolor memories of the way we were.
Gladys Knight recently sang at the funeral of the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Amazing event. 74 years old, still sounds this good. Amazing. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Gladys Knight and the Pips.
And if we had the chance to do it all again, tell me, would we, could we, memories may be beautiful and yet, what's too painful to remember? Simply choose to forget. So with the laughter, we will remember. When all we remember the way we remember.
This is Today in History. On September 24th, 622, the Islamic prophet Muhammad completed his Hajira, or migration, from Mecca to Medina. It was in Medina that Muhammad would win converts to his faith and become one of the world's most influential religious and political leaders. On this date in 1789, the first U.S. Congress passed the Judiciary Act, establishing the federal court system. Although the Constitution allowed for a Supreme Court and such lesser courts as Congress established, the Act set the number of Supreme Court justices at six, including a Chief Justice. In 1948, on this day, the Honda Motor Company was founded by engineer Soichiro Honda, who, seeing the need for basic transportation in post-war Japan, began attaching small motors to bicycles. In 1957, on this day, President Dwight Eisenhower, enforcing a Supreme Court ruling that declared segregated public schools inherently unequal, issued an executive order federalizing the Arkansas National Guard and directing the Army's 101st Airborne Division to the state capital, Little Rock. The president wanted the troops to protect nine black students who had enrolled in an all-white high school in the then racially segregated state. On this day in 2005, Hurricane Rita, one of the most intense Atlantic storms ever recorded, slammed into the U.S. Gulf Coast, causing several $1 billion in damage. It followed by less than a month the destructive force of Hurricane Katrina in the same region in one of the most active hurricane seasons on record. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.